Support for WABE comes from Virtual Imaging, providing proactive medical diagnostics to catch deadly or debilitating diseases early, using state-of-the-art equipment to detect warning signs or offer peace of mind. You can take charge of your health at virtualimagingatl.com. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. The Atlanta Music Project, AMP, has been cultivating talent and promoting music education in underserved communities for the last 13 years. And one of their biggest annual programs is the AMP Summer Series, bringing in guest artists in residency to mentor and perform alongside gifted young musicians. This year's festival takes place June 8th and 9th, and the dynamic award-winning cellist Sterling Elliott will be the artist in residence. We'll hear from him later this hour, along with the Atlanta Music Project co-founder and CEO, Dante Rameau. Plus, our series Speaking of Art features Atlanta contemporary artist and muralist Krista Jones. First, it's time for our recurring series, ATL Up and Away, travel tips with Rick Steves.
Flight attendants, prepare for takeoff, please.
Each month, the beloved public television and radio host joins City Lights as our travel contributor and shares a nugget of knowledge he's gained from decades of exploring other places. Rick, welcome back to City Lights.
Oh, Lois, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Last month, we discussed one of my favorite pastimes, visiting museums. This month, I was hoping you'd tell us what to wear in those museums, or more specifically, what we should pack for our adventures?
Well, you know, that's the key issue here, Lois, is what you should not pack. I would say the key is you want to be packing light. You want to be mobile. To me, this is really important. I've spent 100 days a year in Europe ever since I was a kid, and I've found that there's two kinds of travelers, those who packed light and those who wished they were packing light. You never meet anybody who, after five trips, brags every year I pack heavier. People on the road realize that you do walk a lot with your bags through airports, even if you've got a tour or even if you've got a car. These days, especially, towns are making it hard for buses and cars to get close to the hotels because they're making the historic centers traffic free, which is a beautiful thing. But the consequence is you got to park a few blocks away and walk in with your gear, and if you can't carry your gear comfortably, it puts you in a different class where you're reliant on people who make their money off of people who can't carry their gear. And I just don't like that. So I want to be mobile. And my self-imposed limit is 9 by 22 by 14 inches. That's what you can carry onto an airplane. And I've never taken more than that on a trip. I do not check a bag. I find, especially these days, post-pandemic, when there's some, staffing problems at airports and in different, organizations when you're trying to travel smoothly. If you're using an airport, which you will be, you want to minimize the chance for you to get caught up in the staffing chaos. And a big advantage goes to those who don't check a bag. So that's huge right there. You know, it's a good self-imposed limit, 9 by 22 by 14 inches. We took 25,000 people on our Rick Steves tours last year, and nobody was allowed to check any bag to start. They all had that carry-on the airplane size bag limit. And we just find it's a fun way to shape the clientele, make sure everybody realizes we're on vacation, we can be casual, and there's really no excuses. I mean, I've heard all the excuses, and there's no excuses. 2 weeks, 2 months, man, woman, rich, poor, north, south, you know, you need to pack light, and you'll be happier for it.
Have you gotten thanks from those who may have given you pushback initially?
You know, it's so funny you ask that, Lois, because for years, for 25 years, I was leading the Rick Steves tours myself. And I would, back in the old days, you know, we'd meet people before they'd go on our tours. And, you know, they'd be all stressed out. 9 by 22 by 14 inches? That was my cosmetics kit. Nope, that's everything. And it was kind of a tough love situation. And I always was fascinated by, you know, 5 or 6 days into the tour, they'd get me aside and they'd go, you know, we're so glad we packed light. In fact, we've figured out we don't even need this and that, so we're going to go lighter next time. You know, one thing is people in the United States, I think, are trained to be, you know, prepare for the worst scenario. The Boy Scout motto, be prepared. Have an extra in case this one doesn't work or it gets lost or stolen. That's baloney. Pack for the best scenario, not the worst scenario. You'll probably be okay. And if you need to bail yourself out of a jam, that's a good excuse to go shopping in Europe. Or I always talk about Europe because that's my beat, but anywhere you're traveling and buy what you need over there. It may cost you a few bucks, but it is worth a lot of money not to be encumbered by big, bulky bags.
Mm. Rick, you have written and said that the essence of good travel is connecting with people. Mm-hmm. Given that some may be more reserved than others or shy to engage with someone whose first language isn't their own, how would you encourage connection?
Well, that does mark a good traveler, the people who meet more people. If you have a bucket list and you come home and you've seen all the cliches and you've seen the famous palaces, well, good for you. I mean, that was nice. But if you didn't meet people, and I'm not talking about people who you pay to serve you, I'm talking about people that just are curious about an American, you've really missed an opportunity. So we need to think in our travels about how to be an extrovert. And for some people, it's just natural, and other people have to work on it. But, you know, you got to have a little talk with yourself before your trip and say, hey, we got to make things happen. If the trip is not carbonated by meeting interesting people, it's not those people's fault. It's my fault. There's interesting people out there. We Americans are fascinating people. We should put ourselves in a situation where people can get to know us and ask us questions. We're fascinating people. I mean, enjoy talking about things that confuse Europeans about Americans. I like to have a little tight definition of what is the Electoral College. Something like that really confuses people overseas.
Oh, I think it confuses many of us.
I think so too.
Rick,
but you know, you can go to a pub. For instance, a pub is the great thing about Ireland and England and Scotland is we speak the language and people love to talk. And there's actually a place for that. It's the neighborhood living room called, in short, pub, which is short for public house. Now, if you go to a pub, Lois, and you sit at a table, people kind of think, oh, they want to be private. But if you go into a pub, and let's say you're a tourist and it's you alone or you and your partner, and you want to meet somebody from that town, sit at the bar. When you sit at the bar, people know you're there to talk, and you'll be surprised at how much fun you'll have. And I like to have a few little questions for people. You know, when I go to Scotland, the Scottish are sort of patriotic about their whiskey, and they love to explain to a novice, just an American bumpkin, be the bumpkin. Mm. And they love to explain the wonders of their whiskey and why it's better than the Irish whiskey, you know. And these kind of little tricks help you connect with people. And you'll find people just really, really are friendly and are, if you're genuinely curious about their country, if you're not there with your fists clenched and you're in there to teach them a lesson about how to do things right. You know, some Americans sadly are very ethnocentric that way. But if you're there with an open mind and an eagerness to get out of your comfort zone and try new things, You'll find friendly people all over the place.
I love your description of carbonated. I think you should copyright that, Rick.
Some people say I use that word too much, but I think it's perfect when you're traveling because you want to carbonate the experience, and meeting people is a good way to do that.
Well, I think it also just sums up your essence of being bubbly and effervescent.
Oh, well, to take that metaphor one step further, I'd like to be your swizzle stick. How's that?
Well, a true confession here. I like that Scotch whiskey neat.
Okay, see? And then you have an excuse to talk to people about how you like it. You hear a lot of people talking about the fine differences of wine. You know, it's got cherry flavors or a little bit of fennel or licorice or oaky. I have a tough time tasting that, to be honest. But in whiskey, it's very, very clear. And, they've got 20 different whiskeys on the menu in a pub in Scotland, and they love to introduce you to their favorite whiskey and talk about why. And, it's just, you want to be a cultural chameleon. That's a good way to meet people, is to be what I call a cultural chameleon. You change. When I'm in Ireland, I like to drink a good heavy stout. Mm. And when, if I'm in Dublin, it's going to be Guinness. If it's in the south of Ireland, you might go with Murphy's. It's sort of a Guinness for the people in the south, and there's that patriotic local pride in their drink. Of course, when I'm in Scotland, I've got a little flask of whiskey and I have a nip every night. When I'm in England, I actually brew tea. I never brew tea in this hemisphere, but when I'm in England, it just feels right. So, as you travel, embrace the local favorites rather than seeking out your own, tried and tested favorites from back home. But a lot of people are concerned about being able to connect if they don't speak the language. I would say, first, I would remind people I speak only English, nothing to brag about. But we speak the world's linguistic common denominator. If a Greek meets a Norwegian hiking in the Alps, they will communicate in English. What Greek speaks Norwegian? And what we want to do is remember, if you're traveling, if you're looking for somebody likely to speak English, look for young people, look for well-educated people, and look for people who are in the tourist trade. That way you'll have almost no problem managing with your English. But I'm able to lead my tours, write my books, make my TV shows, and have my vacations in countries where I don't speak the language. And for me, the language barrier is just not an issue. And again, I've been saying that for more than a generation. And during that time, a whole generation of people have grown up speaking more English than ever before. I don't want to discourage people from speaking the local language. I'm envious of people that do speak the language of the places they're going to. But don't let that be a hindrance for you, where you want to go to make your travel dreams come true.
Outstanding advice. Rick, as always, thank you.
You are welcome, Lois, and I look forward to our next conversation about traveling in a way where we connect better.
Travel guru Rick Steves and our series ATL Up and Away. More information is available on our website, wabe.org/citylights. In a moment, Atlanta clothing designer Kenya Freeman explains why inclusive sizing is imperative to the future of fashion. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
Support for WABE comes from Virtual Imaging, believing it's not just about living longer, it's about living healthier longer. Providing medical diagnostics to help catch deadly or debilitating diseases early. You can learn more on proactive screenings at virtualimagingatl.com.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitz. It's great to have you along. Atlanta fashion designer Kenya Freeman is partnering with SHEIN X to drop her latest collection. Freeman was a finalist on Project Runway's 16th season, and she's the owner of Sylvia Molly Collections. Her designs embody bold femininity with ready-to-wear pieces that are size-inclusive. Kenya Freeman joined City Lights producer Summer Evans via Zoom and talked about the inspiration behind the name of her business.
The name of my business is actually my mother's name, which is Sylvia, and Molly, which is my grandmother's name. It came by a default name because I got a cease and desist for a previous name. I just so happened to be like bummed out and talking to my mom one night many, many years ago. And I'm like, you know, Sylvia being my mom and again, Molly being my grandmother, these are like the two dopest women I know. And so it just is stuck and it's going to be a forever situation.
Yeah. What a great way to honor them with your
collection. Oh, she reminds me all the time. She's like, well, you know, I own a part of the business.
Yeah. Sounds like a mom.
Yes.
So how would you describe your collection?
My brand, we are in a position of rebranding. We are actually in a position right now where we are focusing on all the women that have all the curvy bodies. We are moving into sizes 10 to 20. Mm-hmm. And that decision was made because I still, although there are clothing for women in that size range, I still don't feel like it's enough. I don't feel like it's enough greatness. It's very few stores that I can go to as a size 16 woman that I can say, I want to look fabulous. I want to go here and buy clothes. Those options are still very limited. And so we are repositioning ourselves to offer those wonderful pieces, and they are going to be fabulous, sexy, classy, trend forward. They're going to be everything. Like, you're going to want to be that girl when she walks in the room.
Oh, and I saw that you offer like athleisure pieces, but a really unique take on athleisure. Could you describe what those pieces look like?
So for me, I was never like a sportswear type of designer. I was always the ready-to-wear designer. So I'm like, how can I merge the two families, especially in the trending era where like athleisure is a thing? And mm-hmm. So I made some really cute like pull-up leggings with the signature logo on them and like a peplum style top, which allows women to either wear them with sneakers, sandals, if you want to put heels on and a nice earring. It still has a whole vibe to it all by itself. And I wanted to like merge that because a lot of times you don't always want to wear like a, you know, a really nice dress or
jeans.
Yeah, or if you're going mm-hmm. to the airport and you still want to be fabulous, you can put on one of these outfits and they come in like, I have blue, I have gray, I have black. And you can put on one of these and still feel fabulous, but still, you know, very comfy because it's in a beautiful stretch ponte, which is the best fabric for those types of things.
Did the pandemic or quarantining inspire any of this athleisure collection?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a numbers girl. And so I'm looking at all of these brands and the amount of money that's coming in during the pandemic. I was working with a company and on with some other designs, and I was looking at the 30 and 40, and these are large brands, but the type of dollars that was coming in just off of lounge clothes and mm-hmm. easy stuff. And I'm like, these companies are making a crazy amount of money on these types of things. And I'm like, why not tap into that market where, you know, and a lot of times, you know, even outside of the pandemic, we still want to be very cute, but we want to be very comfortable.
Right. Absolutely. And a lot of us are working from home and, you know, just wearing sweats all day or staying in your PJs all day can be depressing. So to have this transition piece where you feel cute, but still comfortable is important.
Yes, I had a good girlfriend and she calls me up one day and she's like, I got an idea. I think that we should make Zoom clothes. And I was like, Zoom clothes? She was like, girl, we could make $1 trillion. We're just going to make fabulous looks from the waist up. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
Okay.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh. Patent that. That's a great idea. So I wanted to talk about your time on season 16 of Project Runway. That was the first season where designers such as yourself worked with models of all sizes. How did it feel to be a part of that new experience for the show?
I honestly feel like I am part of history. It was a first for so many things. It was a first for, models of all sizes. It was a first for the most, you know, racially exclusive group. It was a first, and it was the absolute last time we saw Tim and Heidi. And I'm like, oh no, because I love me some Tim. I thought that it was great. A lot of people buckled under pressure because, you know, some people cannot work with a curvy body. And that was no challenge for me. I was like, bring it on. Like, I was excited to see all these hips and curves.
Right. You had an advantage in that regard, you know, with working with plus size models.
Oh, yeah, I was ready. And the crazy thing is, I got a lot of the very slim models. I never got the super curvy models towards the end. And I'm just like, are they holding these girls back from me? Like,
right.
I mean, we had people literally crying in the corner because they did not want to work with these girls.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, it got crazy. But the greatest thing about the model range was, even the model who was like a size 2 or 4, she still had like hips and butt. And so in the standard industry as a model, she didn't get casted a lot.
Mm.
So we had girls that were from 0 to 24, but they all had like different body types. I mean, very different model types that put them outside of industry standards for modeling. And so the great thing was it gave them also an opportunity to get work in an industry where, like, even though they were small girls, they still didn't fit the mold of what is considered like a regular standard size model. So it was great. It was so many different body types. It was everything. But for me, I was like, game on. Let's go. I am ready. I want to do this. But the larger girls, they were just holding them from me. I'm like, give them to me.
Mm.
I think also the most disappointing part was when I, you know, with the people that I'm on the show with, and I can hear like the comments and the remarks, you know, about the plus size girls. And I've been a 16 for years. And I'm just like, well, some of these girls look just like me. So I'm like, do you have that same attitude and opinion about me?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was sad.
Especially, I mean, this season aired in 2017. It was not that long ago. And I feel like there has been some progression, but what are your thoughts on how the industry has evolved in just these last 6 years?
I think that there has been some progression. I think that there are a lot more brands that cater to larger sizes or have added extended sizing. I don't think it's because they're down for the cause. I think that it has been like a movement and it's a cash cow. So it's like, why not add anything? You know, is this business? It's like, okay, plus size is trending. The girls are fussing. They need clothes. They're buying clothes. Let's just sell it. I think like most things, when it's a new thing, I think it's tolerated. I still don't think it's truly accepted. Even every time I mention that I'm, you know, going into larger sizes, I've gotten emails about I'm promoting obesity. It's not healthy. I've got all the stuff. But here's the thing. It's not about promoting obesity. I think that everyone should be as healthy as they need to be, but that means something different to everybody. And also, it's not my business to tell anybody to lose weight. And also, I think that everyone has the right to be beautiful in clothing, whatever size you are, wherever you are in your weight journey, whatever that means. But I think and what's the best way to make someone maybe want to, you know, do better or eat better is to put them in something that's really, really pretty and build up that self-confidence and they feel great about themselves to want to do more.
Absolutely. That is a very good point. No, that's true. I mean, because you even see it in jeans where you might try on a size 4 at one store and a size 4 somewhere else, and then you don't fit into that. And then you start thinking, well, what is wrong about me? You know, whereas if you come to a collection such as yours and you're like, I can fit in all these different sizes and I feel beautiful, then it really empowers somebody.
Yes, I want everyone to feel great about, I think everybody deserves to feel good about themselves. And it's not any of our jobs to tell someone, you know, that they should be this or they should be that. It just shouldn't. And I'm not one for like putting people down. And to your point, yes, there are so many brands that the sizing is all over the place, but it's a standard. Their sizing is like a standard across the board. And most brands try to stay within that, but they can really call a 4 whatever they want. It could be a 2. It could be an 8. You know, some brands you like, did I eat too much yesterday?
Right.
Or did I lose weight yesterday? Like, some brands will make you feel really, really bad or really, really great.
Yeah. I have avoided certain stores for that same reason and gone into certain stores for that same reason. So,
like, the one thing that pushed me to want to do like more larger sizes, I think my deal breaker, I had just had like a wonderful month, right? And I had like gotten a good check and I was like, you know what, it is time for me to like buy myself something nice, because I don't, you know, I'm always at the grocery store or UPS or work. I'm like, I'm gonna go to the store, I'm gonna buy something. And I go to this major department store, fancy store, I'll leave them nameless, and I walked the store and there was nothing. There was all these beautiful dresses and it was this beautiful jacket and had like the jewels on the shoulder and like it was just great stuff, and it was nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing to fit me. And again, I'm like, I'm a size 16, but this isn't making it. And I feel like I'm on the smaller spectrum of what they consider plus in the industry. And I'm like, so what are the girls that are bigger than me? What do they do? And I'm like, you know what? That's it. That's it. That's it.
I'm making my own.
Making my own.
Yeah. Well, good. So I want to talk about the partnership with Shein X, but before we get into the collection and what Shein X is, I did want to talk a little bit about Shein as a whole. They are considered one of the most popular clothing brands, and they've only been around a few years. Now, they have come under fire for their fast fashion model, and there's been a little bit of criticism of how much carbon dioxide emissions they're putting out there. And even some controversy over their treatment of retail workers. What are your thoughts on the improvements that Shein has said they will implement to address these issues?
I trust them. I trust them. And I trust them why. Ever since I've started working with Shein, they have been the most supportive people for me and my brand. They have looked out for me in days that I didn't even know how cash was going to come through. If I call on them and I need them for anything, they're there. So because I know for a fact that I'm dealing with excellent, good people who have a good moral standing, whatever they say they're going to do, I trust that they're going to do whatever they're going to do, because they've always come through for me every single time that I've needed them.
Mm-hmm. You are presenting your collection with Shein X. Can you tell us what Shein X is exactly, and how did you get connected with them?
Well, Shein X is a wonderful platform that Shein has offered small brands. So Shein decided that, hey, we want to give small brands who don't have the opportunity to have a major platform like ours or to sell on a level that we're selling, we're going to allow them to create on our platform and create in your own way, no restrictions. Create on our platform, sell on our platform, make money on our platform. And for a lot of small brands, that is a huge, huge, huge opportunity, especially seeing the number of people that come through Shein and are buying with Shein on a regular basis. I got an email from Shein, like, it was right before the pandemic. I think it was 2020. And I thought that I was being punked. I'm like, this is not a real email. And so it was actually a real email from them. And they were like, they wanted to work together. And I was like, this is great. And we got on a call and we talked and he, you know, told me about the program and what they were doing. And we have been a big, happy family ever since. The great thing is, well, for me, it couldn't have come at a better time because it was the first collection dropped. I want to say it was during the pandemic. And man, like I was non-essential. Like I was totally non-essential. And we were making masks and everything. And like what I was making with them totally sustained me through the entire process. So it couldn't have come at a better time. I just thought it was a genius business model. And I don't see any other companies doing what they are doing.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that they are most popular around Gen Zers and millennials when it comes to their merchandise?
I mean, Gen Zers, they don't have any money. Most of them don't have any money. So it's really cute clothes at a great price and it's really trendy stuff. It's all the cute. I actually found out about Shein 3 or 4 months ago, my younger cousins that, and they're like that 17 to 24 and they love it. I mean, like they swear by it. Right. And they don't like, what do you want for Christmas? You can just get me something from Shein. Just what I'm like, who is Shein? And I remember having to go to, we were going to Mexico that summer and I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to try it out. You know, I bought some bathing suits, some cover-ups and they were like, the prices were great. And the colors, I'm like, this is great. And so when it came, I'm like, okay, the fit is good. I'm like, okay, this is cute for the price point. And sure enough, that November is when I got an email. It's such interesting, but
they love it.
It's just, it's again, the price point. I mean, younger people don't have a ton of money. I mean, why not buy, you know, a top that's $20, you know, they can afford that.
Atlanta fashion designer, Kenya Freeman, owner of Sylvia Molly Collections. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, we'll hear about the Atlanta Music Project's AMP Summer Series, Amplifying Atlanta. This is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. The Atlanta Music Project has been cultivating talent and promoting music education in underserved communities for the last 13 years. And one of their biggest annual programs is the AMP Summer Series, bringing in guest artists in residency to mentor and perform alongside gifted young musicians. This year, the dynamic award-winning cellist Sterling Elliott has been announced as the AMP Summer Series Artist in Residence, and he joins me now via Zoom to talk about upcoming events, along with the Atlanta Music Project co-founder and CEO Dante Rameau. Sterling, Dante, welcome to City Lights.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Dante, the Atlanta Music Project Summer Series is a major annual program for this music education juggernaut. Would you tell us what it entails and for whom it exists?
Thanks, as always, Lois, for having us on your show. The Atlanta Music Project's Summer Series program was really inspired by my time as a student when I went to the Aspen Music Festival in school. I really loved being in a beautiful area with like-minded young musicians, fantastic faculty, and all kinds of concerts. I wanted to recreate that same special experience for the students here at the Atlanta Music Project. And so it's a 4-week program. It's open to elementary school students. It's open to middle school students. It's open to high school students. And it's tuition free. There's essentially no audition. And within that period of 4 weeks, we're going to put on 7 concerts free to the community. And we always have an artist in residence every year. We bounce back between a string player, a wind player, and a vocalist. This year, it's a delight to have Sterling join us. And I first heard of Sterling when he won the Sphinx competition a few years back. And I've been keeping tabs on him for the past few years, and he's been doing so terrific. And he's performed with so many of the great orchestras in the country already. And so it's an honor for us to have him join us this summer.
Oh, fantastic. I know Sterling also won an Avery Fisher Prize, so acclaimed at such an early stage in your career, Sterling. Dante, how did he earn such generous support from the Atlanta Music Project?
Well, we were going to do a series right when the pandemic was about to go off in February of 2020. It was going to be a part of our annual Music of the African Diaspora concert. And we were going to call that year's festival Young, Gifted, and Black. But the pandemic got in the way. And so we had already conjured up a list of young, gifted, and Black musicians that we would love to have in residence at the Atlanta Music Project. And so we had to wait 2.5 years or so. And we got in touch with Sterling, and he was gracious enough to say yes. But, you know, it's really been from YouTube, you know, the stuff we can see on YouTube. He's got a great presence online. And of course, when you win the Sphinx competition, you're bona fide and great musician. So.
Absolutely. Sterling, I read that your journey with classical music began with a family ensemble. Would you tell us about it and how cello became your instrument of choice?
Absolutely. My mom is sort of the origin of music in our family. She's a violinist herself. And around the time she started having children, she sort of conjured up this dream of wanting to have a family ensemble, specifically a family string quartet. So she, at the time, already had 2 kids who were playing violin. Both of them started at ages 2 and 3 years old. So there are 3 musicians now in the family, my mom and my 2 older siblings. And when my mom was pregnant with me, she decided that I was going to fill the last position in the quartet as the cellist. She went to the store and picked out the cello before I was even out in the world. And so I simply had a cello waiting for me, just sort of waiting for waiting for when I could sit down and actually play the instrument without squirming, which for me turned out to be the age of 3. And so I've been playing ever since, and I play with my family essentially until my oldest went to college. So we played together a lot.
Oh, well, at least you got a gorgeous instrument. I mean, it could have been a lot worse, but who played viola in the quartet?
So we originally started out as just 3 violins and cello for quite a while. My mom arranged most of the music that we played. And eventually, after some time, my mom decided that a third violin, or even at times she would play a 5-string violin, but she decided that it was finally time to learn how to play the viola, and so she picked it up some years later.
What an amazing story. Now, in addition to the AMP residency, you've got quite a busy performance schedule this year. Would you tell us some of the ensembles and concerts you're participating in?
Absolutely. This summer is pretty jam-packed with a lot of chamber music. As you might have picked up on, it's certainly sort of my roots when it comes to music is chamber music, even though I also do a lot of solo. And so I love to dedicate sort of the summertime to spending a lot of time meeting and performing with a lot of other musicians. And so I'll be visiting a lot of festivals such as La Jolla Music Society in California, or Chimmerfest Cleveland in Cleveland, Ohio, even the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. And so I'll be traveling a lot, meeting a lot of musicians and playing a lot of music.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear. Now, your residency will culminate in a performance as soloist with the AMP Summer Series Orchestra playing Saint-Saëns' cello concerto. What's your history with that piece?
My history with that piece, as well as a lot of other cellists, goes back to when I was quite young. It's one of the pieces that a lot of cellists sort of, it can be their first or second concerto. There's so much to learn within the piece. And so a lot of cellists first tackle the piece when they're maybe 10, 11, 12. And I happen to be 10 years old, I believe, the last time I played this piece. And it's not something that really gets to make its way to the professional concert stage. And so it's a piece that I've picked back up this past season, past month or two, and I've been really overjoyed to be bringing it back to the concert stage. Not only have musicians and orchestras, but also audience members. They've just talked about how refreshing it is to hear this piece again, and especially in this setting. Again, you really don't get to hear this piece performed in a professional sense on a concert stage very often. So I've been trying to make a claim for not only just this piece, but a reminder of how much of a first-rate composer Saint-Saëns is and how wonderful and legendary of a concerto his first cello concerto is.
Dante, who will conduct?
So we have a wonderful conductor for our AMP Festival Orchestra. His name is John Schick Conklin, and he's actually from Atlanta. And he is also the music director of the Hendersonville Symphony Orchestra. And he's been working with us for the past, like I said, 7 to 8 years. And so he works really well with all of our artists in residence, our soloists. And I think he's going to do a terrific job working with Sterling and the orchestra.
The purpose of AMP is to provide music education in underserved communities. What does it mean for kids who did not grow up with a mother who was a classical violinist to see you in this role, Sterling?
Well, I mean, part of our effort is to sort of help to break down the barriers that might steer future musicians or future musical admirers away from the field that is classical music. It's not necessarily the most prevalent, especially in underserved communities, simply just for a lack of resources and a lack of opportunity to even witness concerts, which is why it's so incredibly important what the Atlanta Music Project is doing. It's also incredibly important just to sort of show future musicians, whether that be young kids or even adults, that this is a music field, this is a genre of music that is certainly for everyone. A lot of times it can just be viewed as a very elitist and a very non-diverse field. And so we would love to show that doesn't actually have to be the case in each and every kid or person really can enjoy and even participate in classical music. And so that's what we're really hoping to show.
Yeah, just to build on what Sterling was saying, I did not mention that because of where we're located in the city of Atlanta, we're based in Capitol View, which is Southwest Atlanta, maybe 3 miles from the Atlanta City Hall. We serve a population that is 85% African-American, our students are. So with Sterling also being African-American, this lowers a barrier to our students thinking that this is a field that may not be one where they are embraced or welcome. And Sterling knocks down all of those barriers, not only is he a great player, but he's also very approachable and he's got this heart for service. And so one of the things that he'll be doing while he's with the Atlanta Music Project, besides the solo performance, of course, he will be performing in a cello choir with our faculty and students. And he will also be doing a masterclass with four of our more advanced cellists. And he'll also do a fireside chat so that the community can get to know Sterling, not just as a cellist, but also as a wonderful young human being who is going to bring so much and has already brought so much to this field, but who's going to do amazing things.
Atlanta Music Project co-founder and CEO Dante Rameau and cellist Sterling Elliott. More information about the Atlanta Music Project's AMP Summer Series is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. It's time now for our series, Speaking of Art, where we hear from local visual artists in their own words.
Hi, my name is Krista Jones, also known as Jonesy. I'm a contemporary artist and muralist based in Atlanta, Georgia. My work centers on symbolism, and I often work in series, both as a muralist and as a figurative painter. I'm currently focused on a series of murals called Formations, where I'm utilizing vibrant color, patterns, and elements found in nature to sort of disrupt these urban spaces that might otherwise be sterile or overlooked. I'd like to offer passersby some unexpected joy. In my studio work, I'm currently focusing on a series of figurative abstractions. This particular series utilizes fragmented landscapes and avian themes to process through my own human experience. When I think about my starting point in art, it's kind of hard to pinpoint an exact start, but I would definitely say it was in early childhood. Just like all kids, we're naturally born to create. I think for me, the gift was I grew up in a supportive family who nurtured that, and I just kept doing it for, 49 years. Now, it's not to say that society and other voices in my head didn't shut me down from really trying to pursue being a fine artist as a career. Like, that came much later. I actually went to college to study fine art, and right towards the end of it, I switched gears and became a graphic designer out of college because I thought there was no other way to make a living as an artist. What I found as a graphic designer is, one, it's not very creative of a field. It is a lot of intense deadlines and pressure. You know, don't get me wrong, I am very grateful for the 13 years I had in that industry, but that particular industry almost killed me. So I made a decision in 2015 to, one, clean up my life. I'm pretty transparent about it, but I'm a recovered opiate addict. And, I was an IV drug user for 10 years of my life. And a lot of that was during the time that I was a graphic designer. And when I came back to Atlanta in 2015, I completely reconstructed who I am as a person, my behaviors, the way that I process life. But one thing that has always been a common thread through my life has been art. It has been a way for me to process and express myself. And so I think that art is vital to my recovery. The last 8+ years in recovery have not been easy, but what motivates me to keep creating and to keep pushing myself is the fact that I am a walking miracle and I want to keep showing up. I'm inspired by others that keep showing up, and I feel a responsibility to keep showing up so that others can see that it's possible to not only find joy, but find yourself thriving on the other side of addiction. Aside from art, community is really at the forefront of sustainability in my recovery, and also just as my growth as a person and as an artist. Really, when I decided to commit to art full time, I just immersed myself in the Atlanta art community. I showed up at all the events. I showed up and offered my help, you know, and volunteered on murals and created authentic connections through people that were doing work that I wanted to be doing. And so through time and efforts, I've gained these really beautiful friendships and colleagues here in Atlanta. So I'm very grateful to Atlanta for not only showing me some of the hardest years of my life and most challenging years of my life, but also coming back to this city and showing up in these neighborhoods that I was in the worst of times, and being able to create these beautiful public murals now in these spaces that, you know, might have had like bad memories for me, but I like the idea of coming back and sharing some joy. It's important. If you'd like to view some of my work in person, I have a solo exhibition on display until July 22nd of 2023 in the Fowler Gallery at the Hudgens Center for Art and Learning in Duluth, Georgia. I'll also have an artist talk on June 17th at 2 p.m. regarding this body of work. If you'd like to check me out online, I'm on Instagram at JonesyArtATL, and also my website has a lot of information. It's JonesyArtATL.com. Thanks for listening.
Contemporary artist and muralist Krista Jones. More information about Jones' work, as well as our entire Speaking of series, is on our website, wabe.org/speakingof. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., Laura Downs discusses her newest album, Love at Last. City Lights senior producer is Kim Droves. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Do connect with City Lights on social media. We're at WABE City Lights on both Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on Twitter at LoisReitzes. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
I'm Max Hines, executive chef at Breaker Breaker and host of Just Set, a podcast featuring the folks moving Atlanta's culinary scene forward. I've worked in restaurants for most of my life and heard countless stories from the people who make your dining experiences possible. Some inspiring, some heartbreaking, all of them important. Listen as Atlanta chefs, mixologists, farmers, and more talk about opening restaurants, concocting the perfect drink, or supplying local produce, all while shining a light on challenges in the industry. WABE.org/JustSet or your favorite podcast platform.